Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
And they're walking him with the bases loaded, an intentional walk to Barry Bonds.
2-2 with the bases loaded and one out.
Oh my God!
Deep to right field, way up there, and way out of here! Second deck walk off home run! Grand slam!
Hello and welcome in, everyone, to episode 185 of the Bases Loaded Fantasy Baseball Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Kurland, joined as always by my compadre, mi amigo, my dear friend, George. You can follow him on Twitter at @Roto_Nino. George, you can unmute yourself now because I muted you to start this intro. Or not. Come on, we can figure this out. Here you go. Unmute. I got to mute you. There you go.
Okay. Oh, there we
There's
go.
There's the unmute. What's up, George?
What's up, man?
I like having control. I could just shut you off, even though I'm the one that needs the off button, the off switch. I could just like mute, unmute. Oh, man. It's a beautiful, Wednesday morning, I think? My kid is feeling better.
Up early.
Yeah, it's nice. It's nice for you to be up early. Yeah, you're up early, and I'm up at a normal time because I'm on the East Coast time. You're on West Coast. For you, it's barely sunrise. For me, it's almost lunch. But yeah,
man, I haven't even had my coffee yet, so I'm still kind of waking up over here.
Nothing like breakfast and baseball, right?
Yeah, that's right.
But we're talking first base as we go through our positional rankings this year or this early offseason. And I should probably pull up the NFBC ADP data because last time I didn't like how the last episode went. I looked back a little bit. I'm like, meh, not only was the analysis, like I lacked energy and I feel like it wasn't as clean as it could be. And it's not going to be clean this way as I ramble on, but I'm going to go ahead and pull up the ADP data for Draft Champions League since December 1st. And we're going to go off the data, talk about our preferences, guys we're higher on, lower on, focusing on the top 20, maybe a few names after that that we like as well. And that's pretty much it. But before we get started, got to do some of the plugging stuff. Don't forget to check us out over on the Patreon, patreon.com/GTEFantasy. We have rankings live. We have a whole bunch of articles going up. Spring training lineup chart is going to be behind the paywall this year. I hate to do it, but I feel like it is what it is, to be honest. So I'm putting it behind the paywall this year. Not to mention all the in-season, I do 3 to 4 weekly lineup write-ups for those that are into the lineup analysis. So all that and more. George's relief pitcher ranks. He has a relief pitcher chart in the works that he's an update throughout the whole year. He also has his write-ups coming up. Mike SP Streamer has his lineup stuff. Bubba DFS and Deep League content right now. There's a whole lot of stuff we have going on. That's just some of it. What else we have? Yeah. We also have Underdog. Don't forget to use promo code GTE if your first time deposit matched up to $100. So GTE is the promo code there. We're actually about to get into some of those Underdog best balls as a group and play against listeners and such. And
yeah, actually, that was actually the first thing I did this morning. I woke up because I was up too early. I just couldn't get back to sleep. I'm like, you know what? Let me just jump into one of these Underdog best balls.
Did you really
just knocked one out? I did. Yeah.
How was it? Seriously?
It was fun. I mean, 20 picks, 30-second clock. So I mean, you can knock it out in maybe an hour if you're just like sitting at home.
We're gonna have to live stream some of these.
Yeah, we could totally live stream one. We can all, get into one in the lobby there and live stream it. But yeah, maybe about an hour or so. And you got to pay attention to the point scoring there. I actually had the first pick, and it was pretty obvious. Like Aaron Judge is the first pick there. You get like 3 points for a walk, 10 for a homer. I think the same 3 points for a hit. And so on. So
this goes back to knowing your format, just know your format,
yeah,
and know your
exactly.
score. But the fun thing about these is that you literally just draft and you're done. Like that's what, and the price point, $5 is like on the lower end, what you can get into, right? There's like $5 leagues, I believe. So
yeah. yep.
that's kind of where I'm like, it's super intriguing because the price point is there for trying something new and you draft and forget it. And for me, I've been very vocal about giving up fab leagues, and it's because I am doing more best ball. And that's why Underdog was, it was like perfect timing to partner with them, because I'm going to start doing these best ball leagues and stick with those draft champions leagues in NFBC. So that's where I'm at personally. I'll even do some best balls at NFBC, but that's kind of the route I'm going. And if you're a busy person like me and just like to kind of draft, you'd love draft season, but in-season management's really tough because of one reason or another. Best balls and DCs are your best friend. DCs keep you engaged in terms of keeping up with what's happening player, you know, performance-wise and streamers and all that, because you have to plug and play based on your bench and who's hot, who's cold, injuries, etc. So that still keeps me fully involved in who's like running hot and fab and all that and helping people with waiver wire. But in terms of just enjoying the draft process and trying to just kind of maximize how many drafts I can have while minimizing the amount of management, that's where best balls come into play. And that's why Underdog is where I was happy to kind of, like I said, the partnership was great timing, and I'm going to be jumping full force into those as well. And you already have, so you beat me to it. It's a lot of fun, I'm sure. I mean, anytime you could draft a team and not have to worry about managing, it's kind of a fun thing. And I know it sounds like I'm trying to upsell here, and maybe a little bit I am, but I really am truly excited to get involved in it.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Drafting is the best part. Drafting is the best part of fantasy baseball, right?
You mean August? You mean paying attention in August isn't fun? Man, it is such a grind. By August, I'm usually burnt out, you know? And that's because of the content. So because of all the content, that's why I'm like, no more Fab Leagues. That way I can still focus on giving content, try to be more consistent with even the podcast, because we haven't been consistent for like a year and a half plus now. So I'm trying to be more consistent with the content because I really enjoy this aspect of it. And playing is still fun, but the fact that I've found this enjoyment in the content is what drives me towards like giving up some of the player side of things to be a better content. And that's why, don't forget to check out the YouTube, where I have two sleeper videos, a breakout video dropping tomorrow. I'm going to get that audio onto here, so you'll be able to hear them if you aren't into YouTube. But it's youtube.com/@GTE Fantasy. They actually have usernames now and stuff, so it's weird. So if you check out the YouTube channel, it's also linked in the bio, the description of this channel, as well as the description also has linked the Patreon, our Twitter handles, all that good stuff. So I think I'm done plugging. Let's get into the first base stuff. At the top here, per ADP, you have Guerrero, Vladdy, Freeman, Pete Alonso, Goldie. I marked those four names because I kind of had them in their own tier right now. I'm seeing a lot of Alonso over Guerrero, and I want to talk about that first before we talk about Freeman and kind of and Goldie and all that. So what do you think about Alonso over Guerrero, or do you think it's kind of like, are you okay with this pair or this order right now? Where are you at?
I mean, I think I'm fine with the order. I think I'm probably, because you have to take Guerrero in the first round. I'm passing on him in the first round. Not that it's a bad pick or that you can't build a team around him there, but yeah, I mean, I'm still looking for speed there in the first round. If I'm going to, I mean, because I think like power is going down across the board, I'm more open now than I was before to take a slugger like early, like in the first or second round. I'm just not sure Guerrero is going to be that guy. Like I'd probably take like Yordan if I'm going to take someone like in that 11, 12, 13 range. If I'm going to take like a zero speed, and Guerrero did, yeah, he did steal some bases last year. Not sure like how sticky that's going to be, but I wouldn't really count on it. So if I'm going to take like someone that I'm not going to count on speed for, I'm looking at like at Alvarez, or maybe looking at like getting third base at the end of the first round or something with Machado, or he's just hasn't been someone that I've been targeting there. Now, Alonso, he has that range. Like I'm looking in the last 30 days on NFBC Draft Champions ADP, he has a range from 16 to 29. And so I think I may be a little more open to taking Alonso if I'm getting him in that mid to late second round range. Just because, like I said, I think this year, probably more than in recent years, like having one of those top sluggers that are capable of hitting you 40 homers is probably going to be a little bit more of an advantage than it has been in the last several seasons. So I'm more open to it this year. So just like at the price, if I'm able to get like a five category stud in the middle of the first, a Kyle Tucker or someone like that, then I don't mind coming back around and getting a Pete Alonso.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. I think in terms of price, I'm with you. I don't prefer to build around a Vlad. Now, I have seen, I think it was Bob, Big Bob over there, the main event champion, who actually drafted a Vlad Yordan 1-2 combo because Vlad fell, I believe, to the second, like mid second or something. That's a price I can get behind for sure. And I'm not even really opposed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not even really opposed to Guerrero's price. It's just a preference on how I like to build. And Pete Alonso fits that better just because I think it's comparable and you're getting him at a cheaper price. That's all it is finding like, okay, it's very valuable or very similar, but you're getting it at a cheaper price. But I don't know. Cause it's weird with Pete Alonso. Cause okay. So you have with Pete Alonso, you have the third straight year of improved strikeout rate and second straight season of a sub 20% K rate. So you're getting constant steady improvements. He hit 40 home runs and back-to-back seasons with 37 home runs, so you know the power's legit. Second straight season of hitting at least 262, because again, he's making improvements in the contact rates and the batting average has gone up. He hit over 270 last year. I think it was 271 last year. We know he elevates the ball well, allows the power to play, and again, third straight season of improved swinging strike rates and contact rates go hand-in-hand essentially. So what I'm getting at is where I'm concerned, or where I don't know, was last year kind of what we should expect moving forward? Should we expect this trying to continue? Should he keep getting better, or did we see the best and that's kind of where he's at now? Which, where Alonso is at, if that's who he is, fantastic. The issue is I see people projecting growth because he's had growth to this point. I just feel like it's hard to continue projecting that growth versus just assuming he sustains where he's at, which again, sustaining where he's at is still a very good player. Pete Alonso, I'm talking about here. It's just one of those things where do we keep, I'm having a hard time projecting it continuing, even though he's done it for three straight years. You don't it has to stop somewhere. You know what I mean? You don't just continue and continue on until you stop. You usually hit a certain spot and you stay there for a few years in your prime, and then you kind of decline, unless you're Paul Goldschmidt, apparently. But you get my point, though. And Freddie Freeman, these guys are the exceptions to the rule. As they get older, they seem to have sustained this highest level of production. But Pete Alonso, just I don't know if I'm having a hard time projecting him continuing. I like his price point, I really do, but I don't know. I'm a little skeptical, and it's hard. It's weird. Like, why should I be skeptical when he's showing year over year improvements? I just don't know if the improvements stopped last year. Like, if last year was kind of like, okay, this is who he is now, but this is like not the ceiling. Ceiling's a bad word here, but this is kind of like, okay, he's this player. Expecting more is kind of unfair, is what I'm thinking. Because how many players are going to hit 40 and 270 in a year? And how many players are going to do better than that the next year? I think we're setting him up for failure if we're expecting better. And that's fine to expect better or to hope for better. But I think expecting last year in terms of his floor is probably the way to go. And that's still, again, a very high floor. So the argument of Pete Alonso over Vlad, easily can see that in terms of just straight up overall picking these players between one another. What keeps me on the Vlad train over Pete is just, I feel like the floor is really high, but we saw his ceiling be even higher than Pete Alonso's. I think Pete Alonso has a similar ceiling. Yeah. I think Pete Alonso does have a similar ceiling, but you can argue Pete Alonso has a higher floor right now because Vlad's ground ball regression is just constantly an issue. But we've also seen Vlad hit close to 40 or over 40 while hitting for a better batting average. And obviously the counting stats are all the same, really. So it's like more or less I'm betting on that ceiling, knowing that the floor is similarly high for Vlad. And that's why I still keep Vlad over him. But in terms of building a team, you hit the nail on the head. Like, give me the guy who's cheaper here, really. Because the skill sets aren't enough of a difference for me to be like arguing like, okay, well, I want Vlad because no, just give me the cheaper player. And in this case, it's Pete Alonso. Freddie Freeman, though. Talking about Freddie Freeman, other than dip in power to production, which again still had very strong power metrics, I don't know what to really expect here. He also had 13 stolen bases out of 16 attempts, but now with the new rules and the bigger bases, maybe he continues to steal 10 bases. It's just weird to think of Freddie Freeman stealing bases, but he stole 13. That's not like happenstance. You don't do that on accident. You know, it's double digits. So all things considered, I feel like he's just kind of the same solid, safe floor, just maybe expect mid-20s home runs instead of 30-plus.
Yeah, I'm with you. I looking at, like, you mentioned his power metrics. I mean, he hit 52 barrels, had 57 barrels last year. So it's like, you know, right there, right in line, 55 barrels in 2019. And but he went from 31 homers to 21 homers. So, I mean, you know, he did get a bit unlucky there. Yeah, I'm not too sure. I'll have to
Because the Braves, just because I know the Braves ballpark is no, like, I'm not a huge ballpark factor guy. I can't tell you off the top of my head, but I just know the Braves ballpark is known to be a better hitter's park, at least from what I've heard and seen on Twitter, than the Dodgers. So I'd have to double check that. But yeah, it's one of those things that's one thing I think of is, all things being equal, ballpark is the only major change from one year to the other.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but I would expect, a few more home runs than 21. I think, Steamer has him for 25 homers. I think that's pretty fair to expect. So yeah. And you mentioned the rule change with the bases, maybe he can continue to, get, right around maybe 10 steals. So
Which is sneaky valuable from a first baseman.
Yeah. He's a rock solid, like, foundational first baseman.
So can we talk about the old man, Paul Goldschmidt, and how he's 35 years old, but still has, like, some of the strongest plate discipline, great production in terms of, like, runs and RBI because of the lineup spot he's in. We saw the Busch Stadium play up last year, probably because the humidor and all the changes that have happened, that maybe that park is now better. It used to be, like, one of the worst parks for power up until, like, last year. So not sure if it was a fluke, if the humidors are having effect. There's a lot that goes into that. But we also know he has chip and speed, stole 7 bases. And a fun fact is he hasn't been caught stealing since, like, 2019. He's, like, 20 for 20 over the last 3. Now, 1 year, he only stole 1 base, but still pretty fun. I thought it was a fun fact. I'm like, oh, he hasn't been caught stealing since 2019. But yeah, it's kind of who he is now. He's hit 394 better over the last 3 years with hitting over 300 in 2 of those 3. I don't know why there's, like, he's going fourth amongst first basemen. And I feel like if you're talking about value and getting a guy late, like, he's a guy who can hit close, not quite the power of Pilonzo or Vlad, but he's very Freddie Freeman-like. And yeah, there's a little more, concern given the age and the fact that he does have a little more swing and miss to his game, but I think it's more of a passive thing regardless. Goldie, yeah, going forward, do you think the age catches up to him finally?
I'm not going to count on that this year. it's hard, right? It's hard to project something like that. I'm not going to count on a steep decline and suddenly hitting them this next year. I think really you could probably make an argument for any one of these four as your top first baseman. I think we have them the same in our rankings. We do have Vlad number one in our rankings, followed by Freeman, Goldschmidt, and Alonso. And I think it goes to, like, what you were saying with Alonso's, like, floor. You're going to get, like, those 40 homers and I think between a 260, 270 average. And then we just see, like, the ceiling with the other three, with Vlad, Freddie, and Goldschmidt kind of all being able to chip in some speed and having that batting average upside that Alonso doesn't have. And so, yeah, that's another thing to consider when we're talking about, like, rule changes. Like, if batting average is going to be up across the board, like, maybe it is a better idea to go, like, keep up and establish that batting average as well. So yeah, I think this is a good solid tier here. Personally, it hasn't been this range hasn't been where I'm getting a first baseman.
Yeah.
But I don't think you can really go wrong in a team build with any of these.
I just think it's funny that we see so much discourse arguing, nitpicking is probably the better word. Just people nitpicking their preferences and really holding true, like, well, I'm going to, like, plant their flags on these players. I know, like, John Legeza, big Johnny L, one of my favorite people, by the way. I love talking to that guy. He's been on this. Well, to be fair, he was being crapped on for this take a year ago. So now I feel like he holds on to it as almost like look at this patch on my shoulder. Like, I got this award for calling it a year early, which good for him. It was actually a really good call. I think that, and he sat there and took the beating the whole offseason. And Alonso was fantastic. So he has every right to still be waving that victory flag. I just think it's funny, though, because people feel the need to argue over these. Like, it's just like, pick your preference. I feel like that there's a reason why you should be drafting based on tiers anyway, in terms of, like, what and skill set, obviously buckets and tiers. Like, if you want a certain skill set and you value these players similarly, just pick which one you like to build your team around. It shouldn't be such an argument and it shouldn't be such a big deal if you don't agree with consensus. Like, Vlad being number one for us, just because we agree with consensus doesn't mean, first off, doesn't mean we're going to be right. But secondly, we're nitpicking here. These are, I mean, you have him ranked first and won't ever take him because of where he goes in drafts. It's like I said, majority of the time now, format matters. If I wanted, I will try. I mean, I'm not against trying a team build with Vlad, because I do think there's some solid speed options, but we lost one, like, in Story, and don't know if you want to talk about that. We forgot to even mention the whole story being out half a year and my crushed spirits and soul behind, being in on him early. But yeah, you get my point. It's drafting Vlad early isn't a detriment. Drafting Alonso early won't be a detriment to your team. These are guys that you can build around, but you just have to make sure you build around them. That's all it is.
Right. It's something I'm doing more this year than I did last year because I did get burned by having like a lot of exposure to similar players, like in the top 100 to 150, where like, yeah, I had a lot of Jess Chisholm, had a lot of Jonathan India, guys like that, where it's like, you know, these guys going in the top 100, 150, you know, your first 10 rounds or so, like they're all good players. It's why they're going so high. And there's a lot of different ways to build teams, a lot of different ways to win. What matters in the end is just getting those stats that you need. And so what I'm doing more this year than I have in the past is trying to diversify a bit and trying different team builds. So, yeah, if I take someone like Vlad at the end of the first, then it just means that I've got like a Randy Arozarena in my queue, Andrés Giménez in my queue, you know, down the line. So guys like that, that I'm trying to target a little more to supplement that speed. Whereas, yeah, you could start the first round with a Kyle Tucker or Bobby Witt or, you know, what have you. And then it's like, oh, I'm looking at Vinny P. I'm looking at Jose Abreu. It just depends on how you start, where you find the values of the pockets of value at the different positions going forward. Based on the stats that you need. So yeah, a lot of different ways. And it's just Vlad in the first round hasn't been something that I've tried yet. I don't know. We'll see. I still plan on doing maybe a handful more DCs. And so we'll see where my picks land there. And I don't know, maybe I'll give it a shot. Vlad or Freeman, any one of those guys that get the 1-2 turn.
So the next three on this list are Matt Olson, Vinny P, and Jose Abreu. You kind of mentioned them already. These are the next guys after the big four. And you and I have them ranked. We have our top seven. We're in lockstep together. We have the same seven picks in the same order. We both have Matt Olson fifth. And I think what keeps him out of the top four for me is pretty much what I perceive to be a lower batting average floor. But I do think we're in for an improvement there. I know you've been doing your homework on this type of stuff. So I'll let you talk about Matt Olson here.
Yeah, I think he's going to be someone that probably benefits from the shift a little bit. I'm not sure how, like, I wouldn't say that suddenly he's going to, you know, get into like the Pete Alonso range. I mean, he's capable. We saw it last year. He basically did what Pete did this year with the 271 and 39 homers. But he is someone that would have that will benefit from the shift. I mean, just from the pure like volume, like he, I think only, yeah. So only Kyle Schwarber saw more shifts last year than Matt Olson, just on a volume basis. Olson saw the second most pitches with the shift in place. And so, yeah, being a left-handed hitter, no, he is still very much like fly ball heavy. And so that's where you will see like the BABIP is still going to remain kind of low because he does hit a lot of fly balls. And so we typically do see a lower BABIP with that kind of profile. But I do think that he'll add, like, you know, maybe gets back into that 260, 265 range. So there is some upside there for the batting average with Olson. And I think he's, you know, pretty safe bet for mid-30s homers with some upside for more. You know, he's in one of the best lineups, that's for sure. So, yeah, I think he's just really solid there too.
Yeah, you mentioned it. I figured you would mention the shift stuff. I know you did a lot of homework on the shift stuff. And that was kind of the main reasoning why I have him like fifth, because I feel like, although I agree, I don't think he's going to live up to that batting average that the other guys ahead of him are, but that's the only thing that's holding him back from being there. But then the argument becomes, is he just a expensive version of Rhys Hoskins if he only hits 250? So that's where it's like, well, like, like obviously I think the ceiling, we know I think he hit with like 270 a couple years back. So we know the ceiling is a little higher than that, but still it's the point of, I guess technically, like the floor, or like, I guess maybe that's the floor. Maybe that's why he is where he's at, because we know the floor is Rhys Hoskins, and Rhys Hoskins has to stay healthy to be Rhys Hoskins. So that's part of the issue. But yeah, I do like Olson there. We both have Abreu 6 and Vinny P 7, even though ADP has it flipped. Are you buying into the power resurgence now that he's in Houston, likely in the middle of that lineup? And I think I saw somewhere that the White Sox in general actually, they actually were like, the hitting coach had them hitting to contact more than trying to produce power. And I believe that makes sense considering the metrics were all there for Abreu still. There was no power production, unfortunately.
Yeah. You pretty much said it. I mean, the metrics were all there, still consistent barrel rate right around 10%. Had 47 barrels this year, this last year, compared to 44 the year before. But his home run rate cut in half. I mean, 30 homers to 15 homers. Being a right-handed hitter there now in Houston, he's got the Crawford boxes there to left field to take advantage of. So, yeah, I could definitely see the power coming back up. And with that power coming up in that lineup, he's probably going to return to, you know, being one of the better RBI producers, going to score a good amount of runs in that lineup. So, yeah, I mean, I love just from a cost perspective, like this is where I'm now looking at first base, because I think he's just such an incredible value where he's going. I'm just looking at the last 30 days in Draft Champions. He's going at 93. I mean, yeah, I'll take that all day. I love Abreu at this price. That's for sure.
Just to hit on those Abreu power metrics, just so people understand like how good they were. I don't want to like just say they were great and leave it at that. We're talking 89th percentile max exit velocity, 97th percentile hard hit rate, 96th percentile ex woba, which isn't just power, but you get my point. It's just really good. And then a 92nd percentile ex slug. These were above some of his actual performances. And I do think that we'll see him convert that into more power production on a better team in a solid ballpark. And that's why I'm really in. And at that cost, I really like him as the fallback. This is kind of the area I like to live in. If I can get Jose Abreu, it's great. If I can get Vinny P, because he's the next guy on this list for us at 7. And again, we have Abreu above him. But Vinny P, we saw the raw power potential, 87th percentile max exit velocity. Again, another guy that is just really solid max exit velocity type. And the reason why I like max exit velocity as a screenshot to power potential, the thing is people often, and people as in players, often hit the ball harder into the ground. So max exit velocity doesn't necessarily mean they're going to hit home runs. It's just an indicator of power potential, in my opinion. And I know people don't really like that stat. I look at it as a quick snapshot to overall raw power potential. Like Hosmer has a decent max exit velocity for reference, but he's also what I call a ground ball merchant. He just, that's all he does. He just wheels and deals in the ground ball game. But anyway, back to Vinny P. Eric Hosmer's on this top 20. I apologize for even bringing him up. But Vinny P had a 46.7% hard hit rate. He's going to hit in the middle of the order. But the big thing here is that power potential that he has while flashing a 92% zone contact rate. That is like among the elite type of hitters. So you can have that type of hit tool with that type of power upside. There could be growing pains in his first full season. But ultimately, we're talking about a guy where he's going, he can easily be in the conversation in the top 3-4 next year. That's the type of upside I see Vinny P having, considering the skill set that we're seeing under the hood.
Yeah, absolutely. Love Vinny P. He had more walks than strikeouts last year. When you could do that and make as much contact as he does, as much hard contact as he does, I mean, that's some elite skills right there. Absolutely love Vinny P. The only concern with him, and because initially I had him over Abreu before Abreu moved to Houston. The only concern with him there is that lineup. You look at that Kansas City lineup, and if he's hitting cleanup, he's hitting behind Bobby Witt, Sal Perez, and Jay Melendez possibly leading off. But I mean, Bobby Witt and Perez, I mean, they don't walk very much. They both have some batting average downside. So how often are they going to be on base in front of him? And outside of maybe Melendez, no one else in that lineup really can project for, you know, having a strong OBP. He's going to have right now, Rossi Resource has him hitting in front of Adalberto Mondesi, Edward Olivares, Drew Waters, Michael A. Taylor. So I think the runs and RBI are a bit in question, but where he's going, again, if I'm drafting for the cost, I think it's perfectly fine. He's going 95 overall over at the NFBC Draft Champions League. So, yeah, for the cost, I don't mind it at all. I would still take Abreu over him, and I do have Abreu over him in my rankings. But I think Pasquantino, he's just can be an elite hitter. Like you said, top 4 or 5 potential.
Yeah, the counting stats are the tiebreaker here. I do think the power upside is here. So if you want power, take him over Abreu, because I think Abreu, although he has it, I just don't know if he has that type of ceiling as a Pasquantino, while they both have very strong plate discipline. So I would take the upside gamble on Pasquantino over Brayu in certain situations or circumstances, depending on how I build my team out. But the higher floor and obviously the track record is in favor of Brayu, not to mention lineup and all that. So there are, again, we're nitpicking here. Now, this is where I get kind of, I'm not even sure I'm comfortable with Nate Lowe at eight, but we, again, Nathaniel Lowe at eight is consensus. I hate how much I'm with consensus this, like the first 12, 13 picks, but I feel like that's normal, unfortunately. But Nathaniel Lowe, I'm there's parts of it I'm in on. There's things I'm like, I'm not sure what to believe. Where are you at with him?
Yeah. I don't mind him right behind those guys too. I'm just looking at his ADP. He's right at 109. So going just a little bit after, and I do have him next in my rankings just because I think he presents like the next best, like just solid all around skill set. He'll chip in a couple steals, decent batting average, good power. Now he is going to see some regression. He's not going to hit for a 363 BABIP again. So he's definitely going to see some regression there. He overperformed a bit in both the batting average and the slugging percentage. So there is going to be some regression, but I think he's just going to be just an all-around solid hitter, you know, 20 to 25 homers, a couple steals, and a solid batting average. I think he's one of these last of that'll just give you some good all-around production. So I don't mind low where he's going.
I look at it like you mentioned, the BABIP was notable in terms of the what you should expect for decline. But it was like in the second half, it was like over 400. And the second half for Lowe was he hit 339, 399, 566, like ridiculous. With a 415 WOBA, 176 WRC+, 226 ISO, all huge numbers. There were some increases in the second half for Lowe. He had increases in the barrel rate, increases in the hard hit rate, and made a whole lot of contact while sustaining similar swing rates. So we saw him overall last year. We saw Nathaniel Lowe be more aggressive. He improved the K rate in the process. So a change in approach helped him. And we always talk about Lowe being a guy that was too passive. That was his thing back in the Rays. The Rays, he was just too passive. We see it with what's his face? Josh Lowe. We're seeing the same thing. It's just they need to be more aggressive. And it looks like Nathaniel Lowe finally, you know, turn into that. His first pitch swing rate increased last year, along with the overall swing rate. He improved the ground balls as well, increased the pull rate. So he's still pulling, you know, 62% of the balls, ground balls. He's still pulling that. His pull ground ball rate is still 62% base. So there is a little bit of issue there, but the home run fly ball percentage was like huge to the pull side. So whenever he elevates it to the pull side, it's going a long way. So there's give and take there. So obviously but the fact that he's pulling the ball that much and there's no more shift, and he hits the ball as hard as he does, you gotta like Nate Lowe's potential for a decent batting average. So that's why it's like, I'm with you. I mentioned all these good things. It's just one of those things where I don't know how much of it's going to carry over because it's such a small sample. We're talking about a half of a season of all these like notable changes and stuff. So Nathaniel Lowe, I think, offers that. I do believe I'm with you. He offers a kind of like a batting average floor that the other guys don't right behind him with good enough power potential, even if it doesn't fully carry over. So it's like, I like him. I think I'm just apprehensive because how much does that BABIP decrease, and how much does that BABIP, when that BABIP decreases, how much do the overall numbers regress? Now the team continues to get better around him and all that too, so hopefully that helps. Maybe Jung steps up this year and all that, so we'll see what happens. I'm not out. I think what it is, I like these options behind them that I feel like are known commodities more that might not have that batting average floor, but I also like where you can get these guys a little later than low, about, you know, 20 picks on average later. So it's like another round later. I can kind of wait on first base and get one of these guys like Rhys Hoskins and a guy that's going apparently really late that I'm high on. Here, I found finally a guy that I'm higher on than consensus in Anthony Rizzo, but we both are anyway. Yeah. So Nathaniel Lowe is kind of the end of this like four category upside type of tier. And then we kind of get into these power guys. It's kind of like a mixed bag here. Rhys Hoskins, I feel like we don't have to talk about Rhys Hoskins. You know what he is. Great OBP guy. So if you play OBP leagues, OBP, he's like a top 5-6 first baseman OBP league. So you know what he is. 30 home runs, 100 RBI, 100, probably close to like 180 RBIs and runs combined, depending on where he's at in the order. Could bat second to start, or towards the middle of the lineup, I should say, to start the year because Harper's out. Trey Turner's going to bat towards the top, Schwarber towards the top. So there's great lineup protection, great RBI potential, great run potential. It's you know what you're getting there. Rizzo, we saw him miss time and still hit 30 home runs in 130 games last year, 32 home runs actually. So it's kind of the same profile, but now with the banning of the shift wasn't necessarily an issue for him. I just feel like with his pull ball approach, anytime you get rid of the shift for a lefty that gets shifted on at least 77% of the time, I feel like that's going to help him, even though the numbers didn't necessarily indicate that it would help so much, at least at the WOBA numbers. I remember them being rather similar. But we're talking about such a big shift rate that I have a hard time believing that he won't be just better in general from being with that pull-all approach for Rizzo.
Yeah. So, I have this group kind of all bunched together too, these next four kind of similar profiles with Hoskins, CJ Krohn, Anthony Rizzo, Christian Walker, Ryan Mountcastle, Rowdy Tellez.
Yeah.
Oftentimes I'm just like, you know, waiting for, you know, one of the cheaper options there because I think they're all, you know, very similar profiles. You mentioned with Hoskins, I do have him, we do both have him at the top of that tier. And it's just that, you know, like you said, you know what you're going to get. Another guy who was shifted on a lot, I'm not sure how much it's going to help him, but maybe if it adds just a few ticks, his batting average won't hurt, but it's also, yeah, hitting second in a really good lineup. You mentioned Rizzo. Yeah, so what I did, I wrote up an article for the GTE Patreon looking at the shift statistics. And what I did is I looked at the last 3 years and took the overall BABIP for the pulled ground balls. It was right around 220 on the BABIP of pulled ground balls without a shift. And so if we literally just apply that 220 BABIP on pulled ground balls to Anthony Rizzo without the shift, he would have hit 243 last year. he would have added about 9 more hits and hit 243 instead of the 224 that he did hit. So yeah, I think he is definitely going to benefit a bit from the shift, and the great park for him. Good lineup. So yeah, I like Rizzo. Like I said, a lot of these guys, similar profiles, CJ Krohn, Christian Walker. A lot of times I'm just mixing and matching. Like, again, like I go back to kind of diversifying. And so if it makes sense for my team build, this is where I'm attacking that, you know, getting some power here. And it's a great spot. It's a great range and a good position to supplement some power at this point in the draft where these guys are at. They're going from, let's see, Hoskins is going at 128 and down to like Rowdy at 175. Anywhere in there, I need a 30 home run power bat. I'm taking any one of these guys. I do have, let's see, yeah, Hoskins and then Krohn. Where are you on Krohn? I worry about like just having the time to manage the whole, you know, home and away thing with Krohn. I haven't found myself taking him yet. Where do you stand on that?
So I was out initially, like I had him lower and I moved him up recently because I dove a little deeper and he's still kind of just the same guy. Like Krohn in a down year, I would say down because only 29 home runs and hitting just 257, and it took a career high 632 plate appearances to get there. But if you look at his splits last year, it was weird. He had a 695 OPS versus lefties last year that really hindered his overall line when he's a career. Career 800 something OPS. It was weird. I thought I wrote it down. I guess I did not. I wrote considering his career blank versus left-handed pitching. I forgot to write down the number in my notes, but it's my point. I guess my point was is how much better over the career he's been against lefties. Well, and he hit like 280 last year against righties. So maybe there's going to be some regression both ways, but I think he is just a safe, solid bet. And I feel like having Coors as your home park, 97th percentile max exit velocity, a double digit barrel rate, sub 40% ground ball rate. The thing was, is he also pulled the ball 34.9% of the time compared to at least 40% the last 5 seasons prior. So we're talking about like a weird, almost like a weird approach change, or maybe he just took what the pitchers gave him, but he pulled the ball less than ever, or at least less than recent history by long shot. Still has the good quality contact and still hits the ball hard and expected improvement against lefties. I don't see why we should be out on him. I think he's getting dinged unfairly in a sense. And we dinged by us more than general consensus because he's going 10th in ADP and we had him lower. And I think it's because it was just so lackluster. And then when you actually dig in, you realize, oh, him going 10th overall in ADP, maybe we were too low and maybe we need to be closer to consensus. That's how I look at it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think for me, it's like you're probably going to get the most out of him if you take a first baseman later that you could play like when he's on the road. Because if you look at those home and away splits, 22 homers and a 302 average at home, 7 homers and a .214 average away. And like you said, he was he's typically been a lot better against lefties, so I do expect that to come up as well. So I mean, he's still a fine, like, kind of set it and forget it. If you want to just take the season end numbers, they're probably going to be, you know, maybe around 260-270 with the, you know, close to 30 homers and a good amount of RBI. But yeah, for me, it's just been like, oh man, I want to take Crone, but I don't know if I want to really manage that.
I can take Walker. I could take Walker 15 picks later, like next round.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. I could take Walker. I could take
Rowdy. Rizzo falls. And I think that's what it is I find myself looking at Rizzo and Telez in the same bucket as Crone, and they both fall beyond Crone. We're both higher than consensus on Rizzo. You are more in line, and we're not too far off consensus on Crone. It's just that we're so much higher on Rizzo than consensus that I tend to let Crone go knowing I can get Rizzo, and I view them very similarly. Both have injury risk, both have 30 plus home run upside. both kind of, if I guess Crone has the better floor in terms of batting average, but I don't know. I feel like Rizzo has more power ceiling considering that approach with Yankee Stadium, and we saw him do it last year. That's where I'm at, and that's why I feel like I don't get any Crone. But I want to talk about this real quick because speaking of Johnny L, he dropped this in the DM group that we're in about the outfield wall changes. Center field for Comerica. Center field's moving in 10 feet. Center field wall lowers from 8.5 feet to 7 feet. Right center field wall lowers from 13 feet to 7 feet. And right field wall lowers from 8.5 feet to 7 feet. So we're getting lower walls and center field moving in 10 feet, where we all know how center field crushes hitters. So Javi Baez and Riley Green are the two, and obviously Spencer Torkelson. Not that those guys are going to like suddenly hit like 15 more home runs, but you got to like that regardless. 10 feet is 10 feet. And after this, we can go look up those guys' home hit charts from last year and see how many more home runs they would have had because of it. You know what I mean? Like stuff like that. Give us an interesting.
Yeah.
But 10 feet is a lot to center field.
It's significant. Yeah. That's a big move there. Wow.
Moving the fences down, like dropping the height of them, like doubled. So it's like those, like the wall scrapers will go over now. And yeah, it's interesting. It becomes a lot more interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of changes, our next guy here, Ryan Mountcastle, that we each have at 13. I mean, we saw how the park change there in Baltimore affected him. I do have him 13. I still really do like Mountcastle. You look at his batted ball metrics, put up 61 barrels with the 15% barrel rate. And he's going to need it. He's going to need that kind of barrel rate to sustain the power there as a right-handed hitter in Camden. I'm banking on the home runs to come up a bit. I know that Park is still going to take a few away, but I think he is going to just be a solid. I mean, he'll even chip in a few steals as well, 4 stolen bases in each of the last 2 seasons. So, I'm kind of right in line with like where Steamer has him with 26 homers, 81 RBI, 4 steals, 255 average. I think there's a little room for growth there too in the batting average. So Mountcastle is one that I love falling back on. He's going at 158. I've gotten him in a draft like in that like near his max at around 170. So I really like Mountcastle where he's going.
Yeah, see, I find myself just not interested because I tend to take, like I said, I really aim for Rizzo, who again goes right before him now, though. But I usually get Rizzo or I usually get Rhys Hoskins. Those have been my two guys, even Christian Walker, if he falls in that range, if I miss out on the other two. But I don't know. I look at it like this. Mountcastle, fantastic quality of contact. Strong power metrics. He had 609 plate appearances, and a 37.3% ground ball rate. All that. The ideal situation for a power hitter. Just 22 home runs. That's where I get like, how do you get, that's literally the best case scenario. 600 plate appearance season, elevated the ball a ton, great metrics across the board, and still only hit 22 home runs. That's where I'm like, yeah, I have a hard time buying in. Like I have a hard time just being interested because how much better can it get for him? Are we expecting the numbers to improve with possibility of even regression hitting some of these numbers in the process? Like it's a weird, like how much better can he be with this? Even if he repeats these numbers after we saw what these numbers got him last year, that's where I don't know what to expect here. And that's why I'm like a little down on him. And the second half, there were some second half woes that might've actually caused the issue in terms of home runs. If you look at the second half for Ryan Mountcastle, he hit too many fly balls. Like it was like 10% more. It was almost like 48%, 49%. Or no, that's the hard hit rate I'm looking at. Whatever. The fly balls increased almost 10% in the second half. You would think that's not a bad thing, but with it, he more than doubled his infield fly ball rate. The BABIP dipped to 272, and the hard hit rate dipped from 48.9% to 41.8%. So an 8% dip, 8-point dip in that percentage right there. So it's almost like he was like just the elevation, trying to keep the ball in the air actually hindered his progress or hindered his success in the second half. So maybe there's some regression there that could help counter what my argument about being down on him. That's like, I did notice that I found something that actually that screwed him a little bit. So Mountcastle, that's the type of thing. It's like, maybe, like you said, maybe he does hit more of that projection and maybe I need to be a little higher on him, but I feel like he's okay. I'm not going out of my way to get him. Because I really like the next guy on my list. Well, and that's the thing. Ryan Mountcastle is going 15th right now since December 1st. If I look at the last 30 days, obviously he might have gone up a little bit. But since December 1st, what I'm looking at. And right now, the guys ahead of him, Jose Miranda, which I'm down on Miranda. I actually dropped him down in my lineup. We'll talk about it. I think he goes ahead of him, though, because he has third base eligibility. But Miranda's a guy I have below him in first base ranks. Andrew Vaughn I have ahead of him, just like ADP. And I feel like these guys, I end up with one of these guys before I get to Mountcastle is the problem. Rizzo I have ahead of him, just like ADP. And that's why I don't end up with Mountcastle. So I'm not really opposed to getting him. And he does fall to a point where it's actually appealing. So like, it's just I haven't ended up with him because I usually address first base before this. But he is a great fallback option. I believe you that. Yeah. Andrew Vaughn, I have ahead of Mountcastle, or I'm going to. I need to change that my rankings. Actually, I don't know. I feel like they're very similar. I think Vaughn is my look on Vaughn entering 2023, knowing his role really should help his mental state a little bit there. Not like having to try to learn a new position or get better in the outfield. Who knows if he's in and out in the lineup every given day. I feel like he was really screwed with his first couple of years up there in Chicago. Returning to his natural position at first base is a big deal because now it should be a level of comfort there. Getting regular playing time, I mentioned, he was a bat first prospect, a top prospect of that. So there's pedigree there. He still has strong plate discipline and contact rates, decent hard hit numbers and solid max exit velocity. Again, showing positive potential for power. Needs to elevate the ball more. That's a big ask, but he is turning 25 this season, so he's entering his prime. And again, goes back to that top prospect pedigree. So I'm kind of banking on just that bat being, since he was a bat first prospect, kind of coming alive and producing there. Even if he's not big on the power, I think he could just be kind of like this solid, safe, high floor type and almost like a Ty France. I feel like, and that's why he goes right around Ty France or a little ahead of him. And that's maybe, and the reason why he gets bumped a little bit in ADP is because he has the dual eligibility. So I have him ranked, actually, I lied. I have Mountcastle ahead of Vaughn because I do perceive Mountcastle's ceiling to be a little higher. But I think Vaughn is very similar to Ty.
Yeah. I could see that. I do have Rowdy at 14 ahead of Vaughn and Miranda.
I was going to bring Rowdy up next.
Yeah, so because I have like Vaughn, Miranda, Bell, France, and Naylor all in the next tier, and I kind of see them all similar in the same way I have the previous tier with all the power hitters. You kind of have like a little more batting average and less power in this next tier. And I do have Vaughn first in that tier. I have him at 15. So yeah, I really hope that, you know, him being able to focus on just one position can, you know, really benefit him at the plate. I would like to see him, because he's always had that like all fields approach that kind of hinders his power output. If he can just pull the ball a little more, if he can get closer to like a 40% pull rate, it's been at 35%. If you can get closer to like a 40% pull rate, I think he can definitely tap into a bit more power. So I would love to see that, especially with his ability to make contact with his, you know, really good zone contact rate and hard hit rate. Doesn't strike out too much. So yeah, I'm with you. I really like Vaughn. I do have Vaughn over Miranda and Rowdy. Just to touch on Rowdy a bit to wrap up like those power hitters. I mean, I've loved Rowdy, and I love that. You know, as much as he's able to barrel up the ball with a 13% barrel rate, had 53 barrels last year. He doesn't strike out a ton. You know, he doesn't strike out too much. He's kept his strikeout rate at about 20% each of the last 2 years. I mean, and he's another one going back to the shift that he's going to benefit. He's definitely going to benefit from the shift ban. Taking a look at like all the pulled grounders he had. 68 pulled grounders. He went 8 for 68. Of those 68, he had 36 hard hit pulled ground balls. So not only did I look at like the BABIP for pulled ground balls, but I mean that BABIP goes up with hard hits. And he was one of the leaders there with hard hit pulled grounders. And he was 6 for 36. And so in that article, kind of doing the math there, and just giving adjusting his BABIP for the shift ban, he probably would have hit right around 240 last year with the shift ban, as opposed to what was it, 219. And so if he hits 240 last year with 35 homers and 89 RBI, I mean, where's he going in drafts today? He's probably going 30, 40 picks earlier than where he's going right now, where he's going 175. Rowdy's probably the guy that I'm having the most exposure to at first base, and especially in this range here as late as he's going. I think you can, if he's going to hit 240 with 40 homer upside, I will take that from Rowdy here at this price.
Yeah, I tweeted it out pretty much. If a player has a double-digit barrel rate, strong power metrics, like all caps the word strong plate discipline, is left-handed hitter who is set to improve from the shift ban, pulls and elevates the ball, you draft him. And it's Rowdy. That was a Rowdy Tellez tweet. Now, the only red flag, he could platoon because he can't hit left-handed pitching well. But yeah. That's fine if you're giving me the prediction. These days, being in a platoon isn't what it used to be, because once you get this late in the draft, it's hard to find a player, either A, not in a platoon, or B, a guy who is platooning or a guy that isn't platooning that probably should be. You know what I mean? Like, just mm-hmm. doesn't, like, the production is almost negative. Plus,
right, the strong side exactly.
of platoon isn't, the strong side of the platoon isn't angry, you know, or isn't angry. Sorry, I was reading something. Strong side of the platoon isn't the end all be all. Don't know why. It shouldn't make you angry, is probably what you said. Ty France, just kind of, we talk about him. We kind of have him in this range. I'm just throwing names out there now because it really is pick your poison here, because all the names are kind of together. But I'm stretching. Ty France, 93% contact rate is absolutely elite. High floor production, top of the order bat. You know what you're getting. Next, Jose Miranda, kind of in that same conversation. I think there's some power there, potential, I should say, but we haven't really seen, we didn't really see it in the metrics. I just know we saw a really good contact rate, a really good hit tool, sub 20% K rate, but the over aggression at the plate, over 50% swing rate, leads to a lot of probably weaker contact because he's hitting a lot of balls in a lot of places. So I think Miranda's okay. I'm just not super interested at, I don't know, compared to who's going around him, I guess.
Yeah, I'm with you. The only reason I don't have, now I do like that Miranda, he does have that first base, third base eligibility.
Yeah.
So that kind of pushes him up a little bit for me in drafts, just having that first and third.
Well, we're not talking about third base right now. We're talking about first base.
Yeah, of course.
In terms of first base, I don't like, I get it though. The price makes sense because of that dual eligibility. But anyway.
But the reason why I'm not going to have too much like Vaughn, Miranda, Ty France is because, man, I'm really loving Josh Naylor. And I know you're a fan too. I'm really liking
always
Josh
have
Naylor.
Been. I was a year early. He got injured. He got injured the year I was really in on him.
Yeah. Naylor going at 225. He's another one that will be one of the biggest beneficiaries of the shift ban. Despite having fewer than 500 plate appearances, he had 498 plate appearances. He was among the leaders in those because he does hit a lot to – he does pull a lot of ground balls. He was one of the leaders in pulled ground balls and one of the leaders in hard hit pulled ground balls. And so I would expect his BABIP to increase. And so kind of, you know, applying everything that I had looked at with the shift, he would have hit closer to 280 last year. He had a lot of hits taken away with the shift in place. So he would have hit closer to 280 last year. I think he's definitely going to benefit. He'll, like you said, it's probably less is more with him as far as like a platoon. If he's not facing as many lefties, I think just the boost in the batting average is going to be worth it. And so, I'm really liking Josh Naylor. I think he's going to be, he can produce essentially the same, like similar to like Ty France and Miranda. And, these guys were looking at, you know, 40, 50 picks, going 40, 50 picks earlier. So Josh Naylor there at 225, I've loved getting him like as my corner. I don't mind getting him as my first baseman if that's how long I've waited. If I've gotten an advantage like in outfield or pitching or what have you. If I'm strong everywhere else, I don't mind getting Naylor as my first baseman, but I've more times than not, I've gotten him as my corner, which I really love. So yeah, I'm big Josh Naylor fan this year. I think he's going to really benefit from that shift, Ben.
Yeah, Naylor's a guy that I actually moved up ahead of Josh Bell, or I planned to, because I was writing him down. And I'm like, yeah, because Josh Bell just, I don't know what happened in the second half. The dude just hits so many ground balls too. He's another guy the shift last year, in terms of, like, again, just looking at WOBA and ex-WOBA against the shift, they were kind of comparable. So it's like, I don't know. I don't know what to expect with Josh Bell. I'll take not Josh Naylor's upside over him. And I feel like, but they're in the same conversation. You know who's not in this conversation for me? And Josh Naylor's going way later than these guys. So that's why it's like, it's funny that we're so much higher. But you know who's not in this conversation? The guy I won't touch in drafts is Joey Meneses. I can't say his name. Joey Meneses, I think is how you say it, right? I can't. I just can't. And I think it's because he's like a 30. It reminds me of, what's his face? Schwindel. There's a lot of Schwindel comps in my brain here. And he's a 30-year-old that broke out over like a 50-something game sample. And we're talking about small samples. It is. Let's take a small sample of a small sample. The dude couldn't hit anything he hit it. But if you look at the underlying numbers on the breaking balls and the off-speed pitches, he vastly overperformed against both. And yeah. I think he's going to get figured out. There's a reason why he was a 30-year-old in the minor leagues. You know what I mean? That's why I'm like, I can't have a hard time getting behind that. Just buying into the small sample, among other things. I don't know. Are you in on him? I don't see.
No, I'm with you. I'm with you. I don't have any Joey Meneses. I'm probably not going to have any Joey Meneses. Like you said, he kind of really overperformed there, kind of across the board. Which I mean, good for him, right? He really came and broke out last year, but I'm just not buying it going into next season that he's going to be able to repeat or even really come close to like the pace that he was setting with the 13 homers over 240 plate appearances. I mean, he was able to convert like 17 barrels into 13 homers, and yeah, I'm just not really buying it.
It's weird. Like, it's just weird because if you look at his minor league track record, if he wasn't 30, I'd be way more encouraged, because we saw the power, you know, flash in AAA last year. We saw it flash in 2018, and then 2019, 2020, he wasn't even in the league. So I'm like, or I don't know what happened. I'd have to go look into what happened, because is he one of those that went across, played overseas? I have no idea. I just know that from 2019, 2020, those years are gone. Yeah. And maybe he lost them to COVID. Oh, no, not 2019. 2020 would have been the year. I don't know. I don't know what happened. But the minor league track record, there was one. But is it also because he was always older for the league? You know, especially in 2021 and even in 2018, he would have been what? What was that, 4 years ago already? He would have been he would have been like 26, 27?
Yeah, he was 26 before he hit AAA. Yeah,
so he was already old for the levels. I don't know. I'm willing to be wrong here. He's going to be 31 before the season starts, or right around the season start. I'm just not buying into that type of age 30, 31 breakout. I feel like you get burned more likely than anything else. And a guy going after him that I have in my top 20 that I'm actually pretty high on, I guess, compared to the consensus. And I wish it was Matt Mervis, because Matt Mervis will be in my top 20 if he's even hinted towards breaking camp. Like, we mentioned Naylor. We both have Naylor in our top 20. He's going outside the top 20 in first base ranks. But I put DJ LeMahieu up there, and I'm not excited. I haven't found anything in terms of the suggesting that he won't be healthy for the year, start of the year. So if I see something like that, did I miss something? I don't know. But the thing is the Yankees need a leadoff hitter. He led off the most games for the Yankees last year. I think a healthy DJ LeMahieu leads off for the Yankees, gives you double-digit home runs, will chip in some steals, 100 runs, good batting average. I just think that he's solid, safe, and kind of boring, but the multi-positional eligibility plays a factor in my rankings. You know, they're not supposed to. They do, because first base kind of takes a dip here, and I don't want Luis Arias. I'm afraid of getting burned by Seth Brown. We saw Brandon Drury come back down to earth in the second half. I do like Drury, though. Drury is like right there. It's between Drury and LeMahieu for that spot, and I'm taking the batting average over what I think was a fluky power output year for Drury. Fluky as in I don't expect it to repeat, not that it was completely not earned. So that's kind of where I'm at, where I have DJ LeMahieu cracking my top 20, and it's kind of just chasing the leadoff plate appearances in New York.
Yeah, for me, I feel like after Josh Naylor at 225, I really like taking a chance on The two high up, like a couple of the high upside prospects that we like Miguel Vargas, I'm really high on.
Yeah, I gotta move him up actually, because I have him. I realize I have him on a number of teams as my corner. I think what it is, when we did these ranks, I had him lower because I expected the Dodgers to block him, and they didn't, or they haven't yet. So I think that's why I need to move him up my rankings. Good call.
Yeah, I'm really high on Miguel Vargas. I think he's going to do well there with the Dodgers. They've already kind of said that, you know, they plan on him playing just about every day. He's going to move around between second base, third base. Really like Miguel Vargas. He's also one that can contribute some speed. Had 17 homers, 16 steals last year in AAA, with just about as many walks, strikeouts. Had 13.7% walk rate, 14.6% strikeout rate, while hitting .304 there in AAA. So big fan of Miguel Vargas. So after Josh Naylor, I'm taking a chance on Vargas. I'm taking
Vargas is in my top 20.
There you go.
Because it's like, well, I have more Vargas. I have a lot. I have like two out of five teams, I think I have Vargas. And I just always took, I just like the price so much. And I never updated my ranks after the lack of moves from the Dodgers. So
I got to move Mervis up too.
Oh yeah, him and Cassis have to come up. Jeez, yeah, we haven't updated. We did these rankings. We did these like a month or two. It's been over a month since we did our ranks. Yeah, both those guys. I have Mervis and Cassis in that same area. Like, I want both of them just for upside, because I'm with you. But here's the thing, Seth Brown. I have a hard time. I don't understand what I'm doing with Seth Brown, because it's like we saw him put it all together. The second half was really strong, but it's still Seth Brown. He's still batting in the middle of like a really terrible lineup. And he's a guy that right now, where is he going? His ADP is, or he's going as a 22nd first baseman off the board. And I feel like that's just appropriate. I just don't know how to feel. He's actually that 29-year-old breakout. The power we know is legit. We know he can hit the pot for the power. No one's really questioning that. A 13% barrel rate, so he has good quality contact. 40% hard hit rate, so it's okay. Not special, but not bad. Max exit velocity, 112.9. I just don't know. I have a hard time. I think it's a swing and miss. He improved last year, 26% K rate compared to 29 the year before. But I just don't know if I'm going to – I mean, we're still talking about 13% swing strike rate, a 32.9% chase rate. So there's some free swinging there that keeps me apprehensive. And
yeah.
But if he's traded and hits in a better lineup, I'd be more interested. I think I like him more as an outfielder anyway, just because outfield gets so bad. But yeah, I don't know. Like, I feel like he's properly ranked. I've just had a hard time. I kind of move him up and down my ranks because I'm like, I want this upside, but Seth Brown's kind of interesting, but I like Torkelson's upside more. And it's like, but Torkelson didn't do anything to prove that he should be drafted, but he's also only like, what, 23, 22? Like, Torkelson's, I love how quick fantasy baseball moves on from, I've been guilty of this in the past. So maybe I'm like taking a hard left turn trying to fix this. But Torque is a guy like in the past I would have wrote off after one subpar season. But top prospect, like, there's no reason why he shouldn't be given an opportunity to improve on last year. He has some skills that are interesting.
I'm with you. So Brown is one of those next guys that I like as well. Like you said, he has flashed the power potential before with the barrel rate, good hard hit rates. The thing with him is he has to be platooned, and I would love for him to have like a strong side platoon on a better team in a better park. And he'll even chip in speed. I mean, he stole 11 bases last year, but yeah, he had 17 home runs on the road. 17 of his 25 home runs, they came on the road. So
couldn't imagine why.
Yeah. But yeah, he is one, a lot of pulled fly balls. So he does get into his power, does take advantage. Good barrel to home run conversion with the pulled fly balls, but a lot of it is on the road. So yeah, I would love it if Seth Brown got traded, and then he was like on a strong side platoon, like on a better team. But yeah, he's one I like as well for some power.
And let's just talk about a couple guys we like late, call them sleepers, if you will. Obviously, we can talk about how Brandon Belt gets a nice little bump from that signing in Toronto. I think he's gonna DH a lot in terms of just against righties. I don't think he gets the full strong side platoon, but if he did, it wouldn't surprise me. I just think that they're gonna give Danny Jansen plenty of at bats there. But Jansen takes the biggest hit from this. But Brandon Belt in Toronto, you gotta love the landing spot.
Yeah, you like the landing spot for sure. I mean, you can't imagine that they're paying him $9 million to just sit on the bench. So I think he's going to DH plenty, at least against right-handers. He's going to DH against right-handers. I do. I, ah, man, I, I don't like that it's going to take away plate appearances from Kirk and Jansen. So that's kind of a bummer that they kind of moved down a little bit. But yeah, Belt, definitely interesting landing spot there in Toronto.
And one of my favorites, it's a pirate, so it's gross. And it's old man Carlos Santana. But how do you not look at Santana and think, wow, this, like, talk about guy who should gain from the shift. The dude's seen like 95% plus shift percentages as when he hits from the left side of the plate. And it's like every year he's like the WOBAs have just been like 100 points different. Like, he should really benefit because it's one of those things where, yeah, he's old, but the dude still has elite plate discipline, hits the ball really hard, pulls the ball a ton. And when he bats as a lefty majority of the time, considering he faces mostly right-handed pitching, he's also going to be batting top of the order or towards the top of the order or maybe in the middle and play every day or most days. So I don't know. I just really like attacking him really late in drafts because I tend to just be able to have him on the bench and utilize him as a CI or util as needed in season. I just think he's a really fun old, like, one of the, like, talk about the old man breakout or like, hey, there's one more year left in the tank. Like, you know how Votto did it a couple years back? I feel like Santana has that potential to do it this year.
Yeah.
That's all I'm gonna say about him. Is there anybody like that for you that's going like really late that you seem to be really in on right now?
Not really.
Oh, you're boring.
No, I'm with you on Santana. When I was looking at the whole shift stuff, I mean, yeah, he's gonna be one that benefits a bit. Let's see, Lamont Wade Jr. I still like going really late. He's going around 500 in DCs. I like that he has that first base outfield eligibility because he's gonna be like a strong side platoon. I think he's gonna and there's a chance that he hits like at the top of the lineup when he starts. So kind of like Lamont Wade there, like in I still like him in deeper leagues. I'm not sure how much you brought up Eric Hosmer earlier. I don't know how much he's going to play.
I do have to put Hosmer on my top 40. like I have Garrett Cooper there, and I was so in on him last year, but Garrett Cooper upsets me. Maybe I need to get rid of Nick Prado. He also was another guy I just liked last year. One of those guys are going to have to go for my top 40 for Eric Hosmer, because as much as I don't like Hosmer, I feel like you have to just take playing time that late. And neither one of Prado or Cooper. I mean, Prado, I think if there's upside, it would be Nick Prado. It's just one of those things where, do we bet on the upside of a Nick Prado over the production of like a floor like Eric Hosmer, which I expect there to be a floor there. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think I'd rather have Prado, but it's Garrett Cooper, really. I'm like, Cooper didn't do it last year. Why am I suddenly going to buy into it?
Yeah. No, this is like just purely like in draft champions leagues, but like Yuli Gurriel is going at 572. You know, there's probably a good chance that he signs somewhere. Dominic Smith, he was picked up by the Nationals. He's had some good potential, flashed some good potential before. Ryan Noda is interesting with Oakland. I believe they took him in the Rule 5 draft, so he's going to be on the roster. Has really good walk rates in the minors and good power speed combo. So it's going to be interesting to see if he gets any playing time. So those are just a couple of guys that I'm looking at late in DC. Trey Mancini, I don't think we mentioned him too much. It's going to be interesting to see where he ends up signing. I think he got really unlucky in his time with Houston. I think he had like a 191 BABIP in Houston, so he got kind of unlucky there. He kind of faded at the end of the season, so it's going to be interesting to see where he signs. But I think that's it as far as first base goes.
So that's going to do it for first base. We'll revisit it again, I'm sure, before the season starts. And you can follow me on Twitter at @Mike_Kurland, @George_Nino, and everything that we mentioned at the beginning of the show in the description. Check everything out, all the links, everything you need. Don't forget to give us a 5-star rating and review on your way out. It's greatly appreciated. And until next time, we'll talk to you all soon.